market share does he have? I think we're talking about Elon Musk. And now it sounds like he's doing a lot of boosting of hardware to the International Space Station. I think he's been doing boosting of other nations' spacecraft. From what you can hear, Paul, does he have 80% of market share? Is he picking up all of the boosting requirements of a whole lot of individual customers? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, he's owner and operator, from what I understand. I understand Google, and there was somebody else that had some money, very minimal, compared to what he's got invested. I know he's not on the stock market, not for this anyway. Whether he's on the stock market for the Tesla car and for Solar City, he does all those solar panels, I don't know. But this thing is not. I remember Rich Antuio asking about, is it a good stock? And you know, can't talk about money on ham radio. But he has no problem. Yeah, we have no problem. It's not SpaceX is not involved with the stock market. There was a statement he came out with. I read about it. I didn't hear him say it directly. That he doesn't plan on going public until he gets to Mars. So, and he wants to go to Mars. He wants to put himself on one of these rockets one day and go back to there.
Hey, you've been telling us that he wants to go 2018. He wants to put a habitable structure without men on board on the surface of Mars, or at least in orbit around Mars. I'll bet you he backs off on that one, Paul. I'd like to believe that somebody in the back room is going to tell him that putting a man on Mars, a woman or a man on Mars, that's a lot of decades downrange. There's a huge number of problems to be solved with reference to food, water, air, recycling, radiation safety, duration. I mean, living in a sardine can for a year and a half going there and a year and a half coming back, numbers like that. Maybe you could squeeze it down to a year, but you try to put human beings into a sardine can. Just picture what it was like on Apollo, where in the case of Apollo spacecraft going to the moon, let me drop it. You got these three guys in these three couches side by side, elbow to elbow. No extra room between them. There's no extra room they can go to in that Apollo spacecraft. Now picture what it's like going to the bathroom. There's no privacy, per se, as I see it. Now, when you're only doing that for a couple of days on the way to the moon and a couple of days on the way back, there's an old-fashioned expression, you can put a man through hell if you tell him how long he's going to be there. So you tell him, yeah, you're putting up with this hell for a couple of days. But for a year, year and a half, I don't believe it. I just don't think the human psyche can take that. Somebody's going to get angry at somebody during that time, and you're going to have war on board. No matter how careful you choose the people, it's too unusual an environment. So, man on Mars, I'm awfully doubtful. You've heard me say that. Now, another good report took place in the last couple of weeks. Up till now, we've been looking for exoplanets, planets going around other stars. Let me drop. And all the looking has been around major stars and looking for the planets. And the good news is we're finding planets around every single star, per se. That's the good news. One piece of bad news is that all the planets that they find tend to be supersized planets in close. Jupiters that are in Mercury orbits, going around in days, going around the sun, that star. So our particular arrangement of planets does look a bit rare. But then again, finding something as small as an Earth-sized planet at many light years of distance, the fact that you haven't found many of those doesn't mean they don't exist. It's a very difficult thing to find. If you've got a nice bright star and you're looking for something Earth-sized, you know, a small percentage of the star in diameter and nowhere near that brightness in close until you make a very good coronagraph. In other words, some kind of a fancy camera that can blot out the sun, the star, and then look for what's left over. That takes a very fancy camera. So until you've got a state-of-the-art coronagraph, looking for good-sized planets around a star are very difficult. That's the typical way of looking. All of a sudden, somebody has looked at the data and started saying, hey, why do we have to keep looking at major-sized stars? Why don't we look at the red dwarfs and white dwarfs? Well, the red dwarfs, the small red stars that are small in diameter, the good news is they've got an extremely long life. They're not that bright. And looking for a planet around them is a hell of a lot easier. And as long as the planet is in close enough to that red star, you're in the Goldilocks zone. And they've discovered a couple of those. Let me drop. So they're finding Earth-sized planets in the Goldilocks zone around red dwarf stars. Now, stars have a peculiar lifetime versus size. You take something the size of Betelgeuse, a really big star, super giant star. Because it's so big, it's therefore got a whole lot of gravity, a whole lot of pressure in the center. Therefore, that nuclear fire in the center is going at lickety-split speed. And so a super-sized planet, you would think because it's so big, therefore it's got so much fuel to burn, it would last forever. The opposite. Because it's burning the fuel so fast, you only get a few million years out of something that large. You get something a hell of a lot smaller, like our star, it lasts for 10 billion years. And we're 5 billion years into that life, by the way. You take a red dwarf, because it's so much smaller, it's burning the fuel a hell of a lot slower. I'll bet you a red dwarf doesn't last for 10 billion years. It may last for 30 billion years. Some big number. So a planet around that star has got a whole lot of very stable time to establish life if it's in the Goldilocks zone. Now, because the star is red and not white, and you're in close to it, that means a lot of the energy it puts out is infrared energy, as opposed to the white light that we call optical energy. Therefore, you and I could make some great science fiction saying that the human beings, the beings that live there, favor infrared. They've got these great big dark black eyes. And you could make some great science fiction out of that one. So I bet you've seen some of those reports about they're now starting to take a harder look at the red dwarf stars. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out who sent this email in that regard. I'm not sure. But I know it went to you, John, Roy, Lou, me. And it had to do with this topic. But I didn't research it that much. But yeah, I know. The bigger the star, the short-lived. Just uses up all its mass very quickly. So yeah, maybe I'll find something. I'll have to listen. And there's another country, China, that has built an antenna bigger than Arecibo. So waiting for that to come online. It's instead of 1,000 feet, it's probably around 1,500 feet in diameter. I don't know if you've seen that thing, Dick. Maybe they could listen for point this thing toward the red dwarfs. And by the way, the Mars thing, they won't be sitting in an old capsule. They'll be probably in a Bigelow 330 BA 330 module, plenty of room. You know, enough to comfortably put six people in there. All kinds of rooms, three or four floors. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Paul. They have so many people to feed in China. Maybe that's not an antenna. Maybe it's a wok they built.
Paul, this larger Arecibo-like thing being built by China, is this a proposal? Have they begun construction? And where are they going to put it? Over to you, Paul.
It looks like it's in, I looked at a map, it was like central southern China. They call it the FAST, the F-A-S-T. I don't know why they're using American acronyms, but it's the 500 meter aperture spherical telescope. So it's a huge thing, but it should be completed this year. It's been under construction for quite a while, so we'll see how that goes. I don't know much about it. I don't know what kind of detectors they have or anything. What bigger than Arecibo. China's not fooling around. They got a big space program. They're into all this stuff. Back to you.
If it's really 500 meters, 500 meters is 1,640 feet in diameter. My goodness, that's a biggie. Wow. And suspending the feed horn that far away from your towers that are around the perimeter, the cables that have to suspend all that weight, that's a big endeavor. And if you're watching this week's McLaughlin report, they reported that China is proposing to build an alternate to the Panama Canal at the southern edge of Nicaragua. It's going to be two or three times longer than the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal is going through a refurbishment right now where I think they're making it two or three times wider along the whole length so that it can take bigger cargo ships. So China is intending to be in competition with Panama. And if you read any of the stories as to the horror they had to go through to establish the Panama Canal, an awful lot of people died in the process of doing that. Let me drop this. Mostly from heat, humidity, malaria, other diseases. Really wicked place to do that kind of construction. So, and McLaughlin people are saying that, yeah, China has got some really big ideas, but how many of them do they intend to really follow through now that they're going through a downturn in their economy? Do they really intend to do all of that? Do they have the resources? So 1,600 and, what's the number again? 1,640 feet, if it's really 500 meters. Wow. The radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, the great big telescope, is 100 meters in diameter. That's, 310 feet or so, 320 feet. And I've seen that under construction. I think it's 60 million pounds of hardware, in that order. Now, can a triple size, can a double, 1.5 times size Arecibo, does it really gain you that much? It's a couple of dB more sensitive, which also makes it a couple of dB more difficult to aim. I believe Arecibo, let me drop this. By steering the feed horn off to one side, you can steer plus or minus 15 degrees with Arecibo. You can look at a 30 degree chunk of sky that's above you as the Earth rotates, which only allows you to see a few percent of the total sky. Even though when you rotate a full 24-hour day, let me think, plus or minus 30 degrees, when you really got plus or minus 90, but spherical trigonometry, we're probably talking about 25% of the sky can be covered with, 20-25% can be covered with Arecibo. And depending on what latitude you located at, makes a big determination as to what part of the sky you're able to see. Arecibo can never see anything in the southern hemisphere, per se, because it's north of the equator. So somebody mailed you it was the same one I got. I thought I got some other space report about these red dwarfs and the planets going around them. And so up till now, I think, let me drop it. all of the exoplanet searches have not been emphasizing red dwarfs. And maybe that's a little bit naive. There may be a hell of a lot more habitable planets around red dwarfs than they are about around white G-class stars that we have. And our star is just at the threshold. Any larger than our star has periods of instability. We have minor instability by way of our 11-year sunspot cycle. You make a star that's smaller, I think it's more stable for a longer period of time. We get some outbursts that if you happen to be in space at the time of one of those solar outbursts, it could give you lethal amounts of radiation. So our star is at the threshold of stability, I think. Back to you for any comments on that. I drag your feet, Paul, in case anyone else wants to ask any other space report type questions. WS2N with some delay for anyone else that wants to join us. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, nothing hard. By the way, anybody wants to read anything about what I was talking about earlier with these boosters coming back and landing on the ASDS is the autonomous spaceport drone ships, and as well as the beam story, the inflatable beam that's now attached to the International Space Station. I put a story, pretty lengthy, but it's pretty, you know, it's informative. It has to be because it's a big topic regarding those subjects on to the Limark TechNet .com website. So if you click on the space portion of the SpaceNet report, when you go to that website, you'll get there's two PDF files. It's the latest PDF file that's on there, you know, for this month. I think I had it for the end of April, whatever. It's the last one. And I've got pictures and everything. You can see how long the legs are in relation to the rocket. Quite a few pictures of of what this rocket looked like as it was doing its arc through the atmosphere and landing on the barge. Dick, I had a question for you. I keep forgetting to ask from week to week. One of you have come across this synthetic aperture radar system, SARS, they call it. So I was reading about a satellite that's going to be using it that the UK is building. So it has to do with it's an increased resolution as the satellite moves across the surface each
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hertz goes down and hits and comes and returns. I wonder if you're familiar with that, Dick. Back to you.
Yes, I am, Paul. AIL, the company I work for, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, did a fair amount of work with synthetic aperture radars. In the case of a side-looking radar, say, for instance, I now want to run a radar that gives me a nice, clear map of the terrain that I'm flying over, and I happen to be flying over that terrain. Gotta make sure I get the button pushed in. I'm flying over that terrain either at nighttime or on a foggy day, but I still want to map the terrain. Okay, to get high resolution in azimuth, I would put up a whole lot of antennas along the side of the fuselage of a great big long airplane like a KC-135. So the whole side of the fuselage has a whole bunch of antennas. And if I phase them together just right, I get a pretty sharp beam in azimuth. And so, as long as I've got sharp enough range resolution in the way I set the pulse recurrent frequency and the pulse duration of my pulses, I got the right kind of Doppler processing, and now I've got this array of elements along the side of the airplane. If the fuselage of the airplane is 80 feet long, then in theory I can build an array that's 80 feet wide. Well, that gives me a certain amount of resolution. Let me drop. If I'm now smart enough to take all the data that I measured while the airplane is in the first position, the airplane is flying a straight path, straight forward, and I got these 60-foot long antenna structure in position number one, and I've taken a whole lot of data. I've taken delay Doppler data. In other words, I've taken data where I've processed the strength of the signal that came back, the timing of the signal that came back, and the Doppler shift of the signal that came back. I've got all that data processed for each of the elements of this antenna. And maybe the antenna has got, I think, 15 elements along the 60-foot length of the fuselage. And that's position number one. And let's assume the antenna is 60 feet long. A fraction of a second later, because the airplane is flying at 300 miles an hour, it's going to be 60 feet further forward. If I now take another snapshot of all of that data, when the airplane is 60 feet forward, and I combine it with the data at position number two, and I combine it with all the data I had of position number one, I now have most of the data that I want, as if I had an antenna that's 120 feet wide instead of 60 feet wide. That's why they call it synthetic aperture. It's a kind of step and repeat process. If you're smart enough in the way you gather all the data of every position as you fly this airplane, you can make the equivalent of an antenna that's 2, 3, 4, 5 times longer front to back than it really is by just gathering the same data at different periods of time as you fly. Let me drop. The reason why this works is the data is stable. Those mountains out there, they're not going to move. All of those streets and street lights and mountains and valleys, rivers and lakes, they're not moving. They're stationary. You're moving. As such, all the data is there, whether you take it sequentially or if you really had an antenna that's 180 feet long. You can synthesize an antenna 180 feet long by using a 60-foot long antenna three times in a row as you fly. Now, this is the first step in synthetic aperture. There's other variations of this called SAR and ISAR, inverse synthetic aperture radar. There's ways where you can fly the airplane in a circular pattern around a particular target. And now you can start getting three-dimensional pictures of that target by way of radar. But so let's stick with the linear first. Linear synthetic aperture radar. It's a technique that's been around for quite a few decades. It's getting more and more refined. Let me drop. In the early days, all of the data being recorded by all those antennas as you flew, there were so many megabytes of data, and in the early days we didn't have, you know, hard drives that have terabytes. We didn't have that. So the data in the early days had to be recorded on photographic film. It's the only thing that could give you enough megabytes of data. So with wide strips of photographic film gathering this electronic data from these multiple receivers connected to the multiple antennas, a very difficult processing process. Nowadays you've got electronic hard drives and things that can record tremendous amounts of data in a small package. And the processing now, it used to take days and weeks to process the data after the flight. You now can do it real time. So modern day synthetic aperture, whether it be on an airplane or a satellite, is capable of giving you a very high resolution of that terrain, even though it's behind a fog cloud, even though it's at nighttime. And the photograph you get out of a synthetic radar, synthetic aperture radar, it looks like you took a picture at high noon, with one slight exception. Let me drop. If it really was a top-down picture at high noon, you'd see everything. When you do it with an airplane, the stuff out near the horizon has a peculiar kind of shadowing effect to it. You don't see the terrain that's beyond that mountain out there, if you know what I mean, because you're looking at everything at a grazing angle. So the far-out stuff, it's got some peculiar missing information because of the bumps and ground and valleys of the terrain. But if you're flying high enough, like in the case of an SR-71, when you're flying at the 70,000 feet, boy, you get a beautiful photograph of what's below you. Whether you do it optically or with a I don't think synthetic aperture radar was used on the Blackbird. That was mostly optical, very fancy optical cameras. So you might have some further questions on synthetic aperture, but I wonder if you're starting to see the philosophy of this thing, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
NY2H.
Okay, I get it. Very well done, because what I read was very esoteric. I mean, all it did was point me to the satellite. You're looking at the forest, and they wouldn't see how many trees are left in the world, I guess. And it's got a 12-meter diameter antenna looking down, and it's going to be using the SAW system. So now, yeah, okay, I see what they're doing. Very good. I heard Lou. Back to you.
Yeah, Lou, you worked for Grumman, and I think Grumman was involved. I think the advanced development procedure, the advanced development department of Grumman was doing some fancy synthetic aperture work, and I bet you know people, or maybe you were involved with that. NY2H, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. NY2H. Yep. I worked on the couple of programs that preceded JSTARS, which was the joint program that ultimately was used in the first Gulf War. Originally, it was put together for a second echelon of tank attack by the Warsaw Pact through the Fulda Gap of Europe, Germany, and this would be a way to track the tanks. You're right about the resolution, very high quality resolution. Jerry McNiff was the VP, I think he became a VP at Grumman. He was like our head mathematician, and he introduced us to quaternions, which are complex numbers but with an extra dimension. And apparently they're very useful for spatial rotation. So yeah, we were heavily into it.
He maybe didn't invent quaternions. Quaternions is a term that first came about in the Krauss's book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950. And on the phased array antenna analysis section of Krauss's book, he also talked about quaternions. What's really happening with if I put two antenna elements side by side, and I hook them together to a power divider, power summer. That's an interferometer, okay? As I take the target off of foresight and start moving it in azimuth of these two antennas that are side by side, as I move the target in azimuth, one antenna is further away, one antenna is closer to that target. So you start getting a phase shift of the signal that's being received by those two antennas. Eventually you move the target far enough, the phase shift goes to 360 degrees, and then it repeats. 361 degrees will give you the exact same electronic performance as 1 degree, because it's a cyclic thing. You can't get a phase shift beyond 360 degrees before it repeats, mathematically speaking. If I take the sine of 361 degrees or the sine of 1 degree, I get the exact same answer. And you do take sines and cosines of the signals being picked up by your individual elements in order to synthesize the antenna pattern. I think this is close to what you're talking about with quaternions, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW.
NY2H. Yeah, and he, I think at the time, I'm trying to think, because I was on a few projects with Grumman. I think we were using VAX, PDP, VAX computers at the time. And they used to run flights. I was in Calverton at that time, and they'd run those flights over Calverton, and the imagery we would get, you'd see the runway so clearly. Again, you know, it looked like a photographic image. And, of course, the fence around Calverton would be very bright, and you would see that. And you're also right, there were a few different modes. So with the tanks, some of them are, I believe, for motion. so you could probably deduce speed and things like that. And other ones, I think, were for the best imagery that you could get. But that was the concept. They'd fly the Ark, and it was as if they had a big physical antenna in the sky. Cool stuff.
I can tell, Lou, that you're coming into the eastern input, 975, 375. And a week or two ago, the data link and the gain setups and whatever between the eastern and western input of the LIMOX system, the gain was set very high on the audio that came out of 375 from 85 a couple of weeks ago. It looks like you and Eric or both did something to align the thing just right. Whether I listen to you directly on the input at 975, which I've just done, the output of 375, or the output of 85, you sound essentially the same. The guys got it lined up real nice. I presume there's a good RF link between the two. And somebody's been doing some hard work, and you got it just right. Let's hope it stays there. NY2H, A2RAW, go ahead, Lou.
NY2H, well, that's total. I do not do any of that. Eric is kind of a one-man show, if you will. But, so he gets all the credit for that. The only thing I do notice tonight, I was listening, is that it appears people are just talking in Glen Oaks that, the link isn't tickling the ID in Selden. In other words, Selden isn't IDing every 10 minutes. So I sent Eric off an email. And that might just be a function of the way the control is wired or what have you. I assume it will be IDing now since I'm using it locally. And the reason I'm using it is because... handy. Vertical antenna on the roof. That's the only way I can hit plain view with that handy talkie. So I'm using a makeshift antenna, which probably would be noisy into Glen Oaks, so figured I'd come into Selden. But yeah, I haven't heard any dropouts, so he may have also fixed that problem. Selden seems to have been up throughout the whole TechNet, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, I got two questions for you, Lou. Since Eric is essentially a one-man show, have there been other people, you in particular, and N2YO, K2YO, Bernie, and others, has Eric brought Bernie, you, and maybe a third person up to speed on the whole system? Or it's such an elaborate system. If Eric should suddenly get sick, and he's in the hospital, heaven forbid, would you guys be able to maintain it? Is there enough common knowledge in the support crew to be able to keep it all flying? And if the answer is we're not sure, I'm wondering if there should be some apprenticeship classes initiated. Maybe this really should be discussed offline. NY2H, K2RAW.
NY2H. Yeah, probably. But, you know, they've got a... We don't have a deep bench, but we have a... I mean, you got heavy hitters in there. You got the two Steves. You know, they do this for a living also. And, but yeah, it'd be good to document everything. And, yeah, we'll get that done, I guess. But, yeah, he does a lot of work, and he may come back into the fold and do some stuff, too. But I can understand it, you know, if one person has to lead, in a sense, because otherwise people are doing their own things, and sometimes it's counterproductive, or, you know, you cross purposes, so you don't want that to occur. But you're right, you know. But a lot of times, I'll tell you what it is, he's a MacGyver, so a lot of times he'll fashion something up, and, you know, it may not be standard off the shelf. So
question I had for you. You might not know this one, and maybe you've heard it from Eric. For about 2 weeks now, Glenn Ifill on TBS is not there. There's a whole lot of shows her name is on the show, and nobody gives an explanation. Where is Glenn? We haven't seen Glenn in 2 or 3 weeks because everybody is so quiet. I am guessing she might be going through some form of health recovery situation. What have you heard any words? And where is Glenn Ifill? Over to you, Lou. Get your eyes on you.
No idea. And yeah, you worry when things like that happen. And maybe they're keeping it quiet. So I do not know. An update as to last week's discussion. We were talking about Stephen Greer, and I guess you've got the comments from Roy in the email, which I did. And I respect Roy very much, and he made some points concerning some of the things that Greer was a proponent of, which probably should have been debunked. So he off the fence again to the side of skepticism, you know. Despite your observation and mine that he did have a lot of, well, it seemed to he had a lot of military type witnesses, etc. But maybe that needs closer examination too, as Roy was saying. A lot of it may have been secondhand. So back to that NY2H.
He is quoting a lot of individual people, their title, their important positions, what they said, and what they wrote. In a number of cases, he's presenting on the screen the document the person wrote that said certain specific things about UFOs. Now, because he quoted so many people whose names you and I recognize, very important people, and because we hear nothing about those people complaining that they're being misquoted, I thought that adds a fair amount of credibility to what he is saying. I think what Roy is saying, that a number of those people he is quoting are no longer with us, they're silent keys. If that's true, then the plot thickens. So, is he quoting living people? Is he giving documentation, written documentation of living people, and those living people not protesting that he's quoting them in this manner? So, Roy is of the opinion, from Roy's writings, that that Greer might be misquoting, exaggerating, and quoting people that are no longer with us. Is that the impression you got from what Roy was saying, Lou? NY2H, K2IW?
Yeah, more or less. And I don't know if Roy is listening live. He can jump in. Although I believe he probably records.
Roy is on EchoLink.
But if he's in there, he could jump in and but yeah, so he kind of debunked a lot of it. And you know, as I say, as far as I'm concerned, Roy's one of the more credible folks among us. He generally cites chapter and verse and is evidence-based, so I kind of respect that.
Yeah, there's a good chance here that I'm now misquoting Roy. Roy, if you're there, give us your impression of Stephen Greer. Each of these YouTube videos you can see on Stephen Greer, many of them go on for an hour, hour and a half. It's a lot of data to pour through. But still, the general impression, at first when you review the Stephen Greer material, you're led to believe that there's an awful lot of UFO data that has been gathered by our significant organizations, and that only certain key people are allowed to see it, partially because somebody is judging ahead of time, could these people tolerate that information? Would it drive them crazy? Would it say that, hey, this is this is nuts, I don't want to hear any more of it, or would they say, yeah, there's really something to it? So that's one of the impressions he gives. Let's see what Roy's going to say. I hope Roy is with us.
He's on Echo Link, Dick, so you have to give him time.
Roger, Dodger. So AC2GS will give you some time. K2RIW in the TechNet. Say whatever you like, Roy.
He just texted in. He has no mic on the Echo Link, Dick.
Oh, boy, we got the opportunity to say all kinds of things about him now. And he can't counter us. He can be keying the microphone and sending back in Morse code. No mic on the Echo Link. Huh. Hey, John, we got to buy him a mic. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I wonder if you had a chance to see any of the Stephen Greer information, John. Also, I sent you an email that when you get a chance, send me a copy of some of the things we talked about on the phone, because when something is sent out with a large distribution, there's something about my system that throws it away for fear that it's got some kind of malware in it. I think my system is too conservative. I've got to talk to my son on that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. That wasn't a broadcast memo that was individually sent out. I know, I checked, I went back and looked at them before I deleted them. They were sent just to me. There was nothing about, you know, being CC'd to anybody else. So whether they sent a separate one to you, I don't know, Dick. But, yeah, Dr. Roy with no mic. He's got $1 million worth of radios over there, and he's playing with Echo Link. I don't know.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Lou.
There was some email going back and forth, and Roy and John and I think Wesley and you and me. And whenever I responded to them, the email that went to you got bounced back. In other words, I got a notification, and the code was that it went into your spam filter. So certainly some of that correspondence of last week, at least I got notified that it had gone into your spam filter. So I assume you didn't see it.
And I looked at my spam filter, and it's not there. There's a certain class of information that looks so wicked that our system set up by my son will throw it away and not even put it in the spam filter. So there's a number of things that people have tried to send me that fell into a certain category where I get no clue that anything was sent to me. On top of that, I'm not a member at any of the social networking things, Yahoo or whatever. So I know that there's a number of mail distributions by Yahoo. I get none of those. So if you get a chance, Lou, and you could mail me a couple of those. It sounds like John has already deleted them. If you could mail me a copy of some of those, I'd appreciate it. I'm listed in QRZ.com, among other places, so and my call letters at RIWproducts.com will also get it directly to me. NY2H, K2RIW.
All right, I'll see if I haven't deleted them yet. If I still have them, I'll send them over to you, and hopefully they won't get bounced for the same reason. Sounds like he has it set up, so if there are a number of recipients, he bounces it. But at least it does send a message back to the sender, and it actually tells you why. It says, you know, it said it was rejected by the spam filter. So I will send them. If I do, I will shoot them right over.
Yeah, I guess what we got to do is we got to whitelist certain people. There's a Bayesian filter that looks at certain kinds of statistics that it thinks represents a spam. So sometimes a person will mail me a nice, innocent memo, but he just happens to use certain word combinations or address and combinations, and our spam filter will reject it. And sometimes it goes into the spam filter, a copy, and sometimes it really gets rejected. It gets kicked out of the front door even before it gets into the house. And I get no notice. And occasionally the person who sends something to me that gets rejected, they don't even get a notice of rejection. It goes straight into a black file somewhere, a black hole somewhere. Okay, this was TechNet number 1601. That was Space Report number 200 of the series. We've almost settled all these issues, John. And so we'll be back next week just to tie the final ribbons on all these issues. I mean, after this, we understand how interferometers work, how synthetic aperture works, how a radio multipath works, the sensitivity of receivers that have real antennas connected to a real environment, and the desensitization. We know all these things now, John. So it's almost the end of the TechNet. After 1600, we've got all these things nailed down, and so there's no problem. We can almost dry up and go away. KC2WGB for any rebuttal on that crazy statement. K2IW TechNet. Great, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I think there could only possibly be maybe one or two more questions that we have to pull a rabbit out of the hat for, and that'll be the end.
Sure.
Nice and easy. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, sending the questions in, and participating in the net. It's always fun. At least for me it is. Guys, have fun and be kind to each other. It's a hobby, and let's use it well. Paul, over to you, sir.
Okay, this is WS2N. Well, I'm glad to be here another week. We'll be here for 201, hopefully so. And John, have a good night. Dick, same to you. And I, for one, think in a couple of years we're going to be talking about a spacecraft going to Mars. All crowded in a little capsule. Maybe they'll use one of those blow-up things, Dick, you know? A couple of big blow-up spacecraft gang together. We'll talk about that. And what kind of DB loss that they're going to have on the way to when they get to Mars. Back to you, Dick. KWS2N, we'll be clear.
So, yes, he is proposing to send a spacecraft to Mars and maybe the surface of Mars approximately 2018, unmanned. So, that's a pretty big investment, showing that, yes, you can get a spacecraft to Mars and maybe even land a inflatable, habitable structure on Mars. But boy, although it sounds like that's a good step in the right direction, there's a zillion steps between there, if he does it, and sending a man. So it sounds like you believe he's going to do that. He has said so. My last question to you, Paul, is from what you now know and what you now believe, how soon do you think we might attempt to send a man or woman to the surface of Mars, or even to in orbit of Mars? WS2N, K2RIW.
I'm figuring NASA for 2035. Elon Musk, he's going to need a lot of help to actually send a human to Mars. You know, I don't see it. But he wants to be able to show that he can get a spacecraft there at least. And that's what the goal of this particular flight is going to be. Now, it might be delayed. It might be delayed till, say, 2020 if he runs into problems. They all tend to do that. NASA just got involved with the InSight mission, which was canceled. That would be 2 years from now. That was supposed to go this year. In fact, just this week, ESA, European Space Agency, temporarily canceled the rover mission that they planned on sending up in 2018. It was called the ExoMars 2018 mission. Now it's called the ExoMars 2020 mission. So this all happens. We're used to delays and when it comes to the space enthusiasts. Back to you, Dick.
If we were colonizing the moon, it's 1,000 times easier as far as distance, space exposure, and whatever. Is anybody talking about colonizing the moon before colonizing Mars? Or is everybody thinking that Mars is so exciting and the moon is so boring because we've already been there that nobody is talking about colonizing the moon? Are we bypassing the moon entirely, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I hope not. I was, you know, if it was me, I'd be pushing for the moon. I would want it to be a base, a couple hundred people living on the moon before we shot for Mars, but it's not going that way. European Space Agency is pushing for it. They would like to see some kind of a base on the moon. China has plans on putting some kind of a permanent base on the moon, and even India, long-term plans. They plan on having their first launch in about 4 or 5 years of their own astronauts. So I don't know. You have to live a long time to see all these things happen. But right now it's Mars. Either Elon Musk or NASA. I think a combination of both, and maybe a couple of countries thrown in. Definitely European Space Agency is probably going to be involved with NASA and maybe Russia. We'll see. Time will tell. That's why I like talking about space history. You know, you can't change the past. Talking about the future is very difficult. The past is hard enough to remember. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think it was Yogi Berra or somebody like that said that. Prediction is difficult, particularly if it involves the future or something along those lines. So the sound is that we're almost bypassing the moon to go to Mars. The severity of the weather on the moon and the severity of the weather on Mars is very similar. Weird temperature fluctuations. Mars mostly very, very cold. The moon both super hot and super cold. The temperatures on the moon go to numbers like minus 250 degrees at night, plus 300 degrees Fahrenheit in the day. I'm trying to remember where I put that in my machine there. I worked out some of those numbers. Yes, there it is. Plus 300 degrees in the daytime, minus 240 degrees at nighttime on the moon. And a 28-day day. Those are ridiculous temperatures. In both directions, those are life-threatening temperatures. You can freeze the living daylight out of a astronaut, or you can cook them. It'd be well done on both sides at 300 degrees Fahrenheit. So putting an astronaut on the surface of the moon and letting him sit there for a lunar day, even if he has enough oxygen, water, and fuel, that's only half the problem. By some magic, you've got to dig him into a habitat a good number of tens of meters below the surface where the temperature is more steady, and you got to put him down there in that habitat and close the door, because that weather out there is going to be wicked. Let me drop it. I just realized, close the door is on the assumption that you've got air. Ain't no air. All you got to do is put him in the habitat. You don't have to close the door. Maybe you want to close the door to the habitat so you can pressurize it, so that for the first time in 6 hours you can take off that damn spacesuit and literally clean out his diaper so he doesn't get diaper rash. Huh. I mean, it's very exciting to watch astronauts doing a spacewalk with that spacesuit on. Some of the specifics of what goes on there. You can find out some of those specifics by reading this great book by Mary Roach. Mary Roach wrote a book entitled Packing for Mars. Very well done book. So she's got a lot of inside information as to what the astronauts really live with. 73, you guys. As John already said, be kind to each other. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW.
Gentlemen, wonderful net. KC2WGB clear.
And WS2N clear 73.
2VL. Repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System. Node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30, W2VL Repeater System.